My name is Mike Zuba. I am 82 years old, not 87. Today is Sunday, December the 15th, 2019. We're in Yuma, Arizona. The name of my son's name is Mike Zuba. He's going to be interviewing me.
My name is Mike Zuba, Jr., and I'm currently 62. Today is Sunday, December 15th, 2019, and we are recording here in Yuma, Arizona. The name of my interview partner is my father, Mike Zuba, and looking forward to the interview. Okay, Dad, I really wanted to find out a lot about Grandpa, and I don't know as much as I'd like to, so can you just share with me and everybody that will be listening to this recording about our namesake, Mike Zuba, and where he came from and how he wound up in Tucson, Arizona?
My dad, Mike Zuba, left Romania at the age of 16 years old. His mother put him on a boat because there were so many of her men killed in wars back way back there in the night before 1900s. He got on this ship, and he met a couple of children from Argentina. And from Romania to Argentina, these two little children taught my dad how to speak Spanish. By the time they got to Argentina, my dad had run out of money and didn't have enough money to continue to go to the United States, which was his ultimate goal. So my dad was hired by these children's father who owned a cattle ranch in Argentina. He spent a couple of years there working for them, and they wanted to retire, so they sold the ranch, and my dad did not care for the new owner, so he went to work for a while in the gold mines in Argentina. After he earned enough money, he boarded the ship again, and he got as far as, I think, near Brownsville, Texas, but it was in Mexico. He found out that the quota for immigrants to come into the United States at Ellis Island had been filled, and he couldn't get in. So he decided, well, I'm going to go to the United States anyway. So he crossed the border into Brownsville, Texas. And from there, he went to Toledo, Ohio, because he found out that there was a group of Romanians in a neighborhood, and he went there to feel good. Anyway, he got a job in the Ford Foundries there in Toledo. After a while, the big flu epidemic hit, and my dad was sick, so he went to see a doctor. The doctor told him, "Mr. Zuba, you're going to have to get on a boat. You're on a ship, a train, and go to California. And I would advise you to do it tomorrow morning. I have lost a lot of people in this flu epidemic, and this is the only thing that can help you get away from having the flu." My dad then packed up all of his clothes. The following day, he was on a train heading for California. After a long time on that train, they landed in Tucson, and they had to stop the train, and it spent about an hour cleaning up. My dad decided to go for a walk. And in that walk, he met a German gentleman by the name of Ebach. That was his last name, was Ignaz Ebach. Anyhow, Dad says, "I guess I better get back to the train to get on to California." Mr. Ebach says, "Okay, hope to see you again." Dad walked over to the train station, and the train was gone, clothes and everything. So he went back to where Mr. Ebach was and told him the sad story about missing his train and losing all of his clothes. Mr. Ebach, who was pretty well established in Tucson, said, "Mike, you can stay in my house with me. I'll give you a job tomorrow morning." Mr. Ebach owned an automobile repair, lumber company, a grocery store, and he owned a couple of bars, one being the Spanish Well on South 6th Avenue and the Open Door on the old Benson Highway. Anyway, Dad went out there, and he went to work the following morning at the automobile shop, and he was taught how to work on radiators after a while. But he was working at nights also at the Spanish Well bar. Over a time period, he met a gentleman there at the bar in the evening, and this guy had a chicken ranch on Mission Road. And he and Dad got together for a while, and he said, why don't you come out and look at my chicken farm, Mr. Suba? So Dad went out there, and it was a small business. And this gentleman said, you know, Mike, it'd be kind of nice if you, would you like to buy into my chicken ranch? He says, buy half of it. So Dad got to thinking about that, and the following evening or two, he talked to Ebok, and Ebok said, that's a good idea. Go ahead and buy in it. So Ebok lent him the money, which was a very little amount of money. I don't recall all of it, but I think it was around $150. So Dad bought into that chicken ranch. So Dad started working part-time on the chicken ranch. The only problem was Mr. Lee Davis was an alcoholic, and he wasn't showing up, and Dad was taking care of the chicken ranch by himself. Sometime later, Mr. Davis said, you know, I'd like to sell that chicken ranch. I don't want anything to do with it. So he offered to sell it to my dad, I think for $100. So Dad went back to Mr. Ebok and talked about it, and he said, you know, Mike, he said, that's a good idea. Go ahead and buy the guy out. So Dad bought him out. And as time went by, Dad had to leave the job of working at that Spanish Well and the automobile repair. So he was working full-time out there at the chicken ranch, and he decided, well, why don't I start butchering and barbecuing chickens? So he had a little barbecue stand he put out there with barbecued chickens. Later on, he decided, well, why don't we get a couple of cows? So he got a couple of cows out there, and the next thing you know, he had a little bit of beef to barbecue. And he got to thinking, you know, beef takes a long time to grow, and it's hard to, you know, use them to make any kind of money. So he got rid of the cows. He had quite a few cows at the time, but he replaced them with a bunch of pigs. So he had a hog ranch there, and he then built a slaughterhouse. But now the Depression had hit, and he had many people coming to him, and they needed work. And my dad said, well, I'll tell you what, I got some corrals that needs to be built. Well, if you go to work out there, work on those corrals, I'll give you meat. So Dad was giving them meat for the work that they were doing, and they went home to feed their families. And later on, it went into something else, like building a big old shed to cover, to keep the pigs from getting too hot. Then he built a slaughterhouse, and he started butchering in a large scale. And that thing, it grew and grew and grew, and Dad did pretty good. He did a whole lot to help many people. Some of these people were really in dire need, because the Depression was so bad, and they just didn't have the work. So Dad helped him, as many people as he could. One thing about my dad, he had a very generous heart, and he was about the most honest human being I had ever met in my life. I don't know what else to say for Dad, but...
Well, I just want to get the time. So the sound of what you just told me is that during the great flu epidemic of 1919, that's when Grandpa left Toledo, and then he wound up in Tucson and just missed the train, and there he was there. And then I think you told me that he became a partner in the chicken ranch in 1923. And then he eventually bought out his partner, and that became the eventual hog farm that Grandpa had. So it sounds like it was, you know, I didn't know him. I knew him up until he passed away, and I believe I had already left Tucson at that time. That was in 1981. But I do have fond memories of Grandpa Suba, and it was nice and that you're sharing this with me. When did Grandpa Suba meet your mother? Do you remember what year and how they met?
I think my dad, now, the best way I can say the date would be when Dillinger was captured in Tucson. I think probably a month or two before that, Dad met my mother. They were married the day that Dillinger was on the airplane leaving Tucson.
Oh, that gives us a nice little time mark. We can look that up on Google and figure that out. That's kind of interesting. So that's what Grandpa told you, is that that was the day they got married.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When Dillinger was taken back to, I guess, Illinois to face the consequences.
Yeah, I believe so.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. And so how soon did you come along after that? Because that might have been 1936, and you were born in 1937.
Yeah.
Okay.
In 1937, when I was born, it was... we were still in the Depression, I believe. But my dad, he was one of the gentlest people I knew. And I went everywhere with my dad. He was my John Wayne hero. He'd put me in that big truck of his, and we'd go down to South 6th Avenue, and we'd stop at the Ozark Bar, where Dad would get a cup of coffee and get me a little cup of chocolate milk. And I remember standing there in the seat, and we were driving down South 6th Avenue, and we crossed Five Points. Now, all I had was a stop sign there, I think. I couldn't read it at the time, but Dad stopped, and we continued, and we came over to one of the main streets in Tucson. I believe it was Broadway. And Dad said, "Look at this, Sonny. First traffic light in Tucson." I said, "Well, what's it for?" He said, "Well, when it's red, you got to stop." He said, "When it turns green," he said, "you can go." I said, "Okay." And I just loved being with the man. He was great to be with, and I was always with him and probably in the way a lot.
But, mm-hmm. So what were you doing with him in the truck?
Just riding.
Okay. Weren't you picking up food to feed the hogs and things like that?
Yeah, he was.
Can you tell us about that?
Yeah. We'd stop at these different places and get the produce at these different stores. And he'd stop at some of these restaurants and get some of the garbage that was left over. And this is what he was feeding the pigs with. And I was too young or too small to help him at all, but I was always there.
Right.
And later on, as I got older, I helped him in the slaughterhouse, and I helped him make sausages. The big sausage that we made was chorizo, and my job was to peel the garlic for the longest time, and my fingers would actually burn from that garlic. And then the garlic was mixed in with the pork and chili, and I think Dad used some vinegar and stuff. But we sure turned out some great chorizo. And then we'd also taken hang bacons up and ham to smoke. And talking about smoking the hams, one night Dad had to go to town for something, and he told me, "Now, you, Sonny," he said, "you make sure that you go check that those logs that's in the smokehouse, they're smoking. Don't let them flame up because we don't want to burn anything." So I said, "Okay." Well, we had just gotten a TV, and I'm sitting there watching TV, and all of a sudden the lights hit the wall from an automobile coming in. I knew it was Dad, and I hadn't checked those doggone logs. And I ran over there, and I'm telling you what, they were flaming up.
Oh, dear.
And Dad was mad at me. That's the first time I ever recall him being mad at me. He said, "Look at what you have done." He said, "These hams," he said, "I'm going to have to sell them for 3 cents a pound because they're worthless now. But you know, I think I invented barbecued ham. Now, he didn't think that was very funny, but I thought it was awfully good. And the ham, we ate it. Oh, it was great.
Yes. Well, how old were you at the time?
I guess I might have been 8 or 9 years old. Mm-hmm. Not big enough to do a lot worth a hoot, but Dad always appreciated what I did, or he acted like it.
Now, did your younger brothers, Ted and George, help out like you did with Grandpa on the hog farm?
Not very much. I was always there with Dad, so, you know, I'll be really honest. I think I took more of Dad's time than any of my brothers did. So I really can't swear to that. But I do know that we had a milk cow, and I used to milk that rascal. And I got kind of upset one day. I'd been milking that cow all along, and she was a sweet little animal. And I told Dad, I said, you know what? It's time that Ted or George needs to learn how to milk this cow. Dad said, well, why don't you teach him? And I thought, oh, okay. So I took my brother out there, and I said, this is what you got to do. Put the kickers on the cow so that she doesn't kick when flies bothered cows.
Which brother was this?
Was this Ted? Ted.
Dad, okay.
So Ted, and I said, the best thing to do is take the hair on her tail and tie it on the kickers, and that way she can't slap you in the face while you're milking the cow. And Ted's had a different idea. Said, no, I'm not going to do that. He picked up this little old 2x4 block, maybe 6 or 7 inches long, and he tied it to the cow's tail. I says, Ted, that's not going to work. He said, if I'm going to milk this cow, I'll do it my way. I said, oh, go right ahead, Buster. I turned around to walk away, and she flapped her tail one time and hit him upside the head with that little 2x4 block, and he started hitting my cow. Well, I guess I went back to milking a cow the full time, so.
Now, when did Grandma Suba leave you guys to be, because she went into an institution, right?
Yeah, that was.
How old were you then?
I think I was between 8 and 9 years old when she went into the mental institution in Phoenix.
Mm-hmm.
My dad got blamed for putting her there, and he did not do that. My Aunt Agroda and Aunt Louisa were the ones that had my mother committed.
Why was that?
Well, mother had left the home there on the ranch and moved in with, I think, Aunt Louisa. Aunt Louisa she drank a whole lot. And my mother got pretty mad about not being there on the ranch, I guess. I'm not sure. But people got into a physical battle there, and she was arrested.
Grandma? And
Grandma was arrested.
Wow.
Yeah. And then Aunt Agroda and Aunt Louisa, being sisters, had the right to have her committed. Not my dad. And she spent 10 years there in the institution.
Wow, I didn't realize it had been that many years.
Yeah. I was 18 years old when she came home.
Wow, okay.
And I felt so sorry for my mother in the past years because she had epilepsy. And she really had the mentality of a child. And her sisters could bamboozle her into just about anything. And that was really a hardship on the marriage between her and my dad.
Yeah, that's a shame. Yeah. So where, after your mom left, where did you and Ted and George live? Were you bunking with all the ranch hands, or were you in the house? Or
we had a bunkhouse there, which was a smokehouse.
Oh, okay.
And we had a little house over there by the entrance to the ranch. And my brothers and I, we slept just about anywhere we wanted to. And we had a pretty good life. My dad was we were never mistreated. That's a fact of life. We had a great life. My dad did a good job raising us.
So the main house, which I don't remember being very big, only had the one bedroom and kind of the kitchen dining room, and then it looked like the porch had been enclosed, so that could be a little bit of a sleeping area. So that wasn't too big at all. And do you remember anything different than that for the main house? Or
no, that pretty much describes the house. It was a comfortable house. It wasn't big at all. And back then, I don't think big houses were the thing. And we were all comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a great cook there. We had this Cajun cook. And he could cook anything, and he could make people smile. I mean, the food was always good.
Yes. So. Well, I know you've told me some fun stories about the Revenuers and Grandpa Suva, and that he didn't want to follow the rules as far as, you know, not feeding people that needed food or giving people where he could get. I remember an interesting story about sugar.
Oh, boy. My dad has so many friends, and I mean, they were from politics to colleges. One of them, the man, was a hydrologist for the University of Arizona. And his wife was a real nice little lady. She made white lightning. And Dad also had another friend, and he made white lightning. And back then, during the Second World War, there was rationing stamps. And you had to have rationing stamps to buy a lot of things, one of them being sugar. Now, sugar was used to make white lightning, whether people like it, know it or not. And Dad had, he'd buy sugar for him. Of course, they would pay him. But Dad got word from a good friend of his that, Mike, the Revenuers are going to come over here because they know that they're sure that you have been supplying sugar to some bootleggers. And Dad said, well, no. He said, now, Mike, he says, you got some white sugar there and brown sugar. He said, well, the brown sugar is what I use to make sausages. And he said, that's just the way it is. And he says, and when you make hams, he says, you got to make this chemical that you pump into the hams, and part of it is brown sugar. And Dad was telling the truth, but he didn't tell him that the white sugar, what the white sugar was for. And sure enough, Dad hid the sugar, the white sugar, and here comes the Revenuers. And they came through, nosing around, checking around. Dad hated those Revenuers because all they were was just a problem to him. Anyway, life went on, and we kept hanging bacon and sausage, bacon and ham, and making sausage. And I don't know what to. That's pretty much it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember you telling me too, as even though during the Depression they were trying to ration food, but your dad didn't believe if there was food available and people needed it, he gave it to them, right?
Yeah.
Or bartered for it. They'd help out by building corrals. Is that
true? Yeah. Yes, and during the Second World War, there was supposed to be a shortage on foods, and there really wasn't, as far as my dad was concerned. And people would come to him to buy meats, and Dad would not take their ration stamps. He said, you can use that for other stuff. You don't need ration stamps here.
Okay.
So Dad was breaking the law, but Dad didn't care for the law. Dad didn't think that the law was honest. So that's the way he did his business.
Mm-hmm.
It was honesty.
And it sounds like Grandpa was pretty well in tune with the immigrant population, the non-white family, you know, be it Chinese or Italians or whatever, and they all kind of felt comfortable around one another.
They helped each other. Some of them had stores. Some of them had restaurants. And my dad always took care of them, and they always took care of him. And he never would allow a person to go hungry knowing it. He would help them out. And it was hard to get people to work during the Second World War because so many of them were already drafted. But one of the people that my dad had working for him, he liked wine. And Dad bailed him out of jail 26 times one year.
Oh, my goodness.
And he said, Cliff, you've got to quit drinking. Cliff said, Mike, I like to drink that Tokay. Dad said, well, one of these days I'm not going to pay the fine to get you out of jail. He said, well, they'll put me in there in the place to cook for the prisoners. And he was pretty, that guy was, he knew what was going on. But 26 times in one year, that's a lot of times to get bailed out of jail.
It's like every other week.
Yeah. I remember one time Cliff was coming to the ranch, and he was walking up Mission Road there, and he went to the store, and he got a pint of Tokay, and he had it in his back pocket, and the dogs ran out from the ranch to greet him. Just as he pulled the bottle of wine out to take a drink, one of the dogs kind of got up against him by accident, and he dropped that bottle of wine. Boy, he was sure mad at those dogs.
What is your fondest memory of growing up on the hog ranch?
I think the fondest memory was the evenings, because the work was over for the work was done for the days, and you could rest comfortably. We slept outside in the summertime, and we had a little radio there, and we would listen to a radio station coming out of Texas. I can't remember the name of the radio station, but they did country western music, and we'd listen to it for hours. And it was really neat. And if it was real hot, we get the hose and we wet the sheet down that we were going to get covered up with. And it was good sleeping, but those were good memories.
Okay. Now, listening to that station, radio station out of Texas, is that what got you interested in learning how to play the steel guitar, or a Hawaiian guitar, I guess?
Yeah, that was it. And one night I came home from the State Theater, my brothers and I, and my stepbrother Donnie. Anyway, my dad said, I got you a guitar and an amplifier, and I'm going to have you get some lessons. And there was this little old lapse Hawaiian guitar, and it had on a record how to tune it, so I learned how to tune the guitar. Then I learned how to play a couple of songs now and then. And as time went by, that guitar got to being, it was a good guitar, but I wanted to advance, so I bought myself a lap steel with 8 strings. I learned how to play that. And my ear was so good, I could hear these steel guitar players on record. And I learned how to tune my guitar up to what they were doing. And I was good at it. After a while, I got myself a 12-string double-neck steel guitar, and it had legs. And the next thing I know, Bud Isaacs made a recording for Webb Pierce, and he came out with the first pedal steel guitar. And I thought, my God, I've got to have that. So I bought a pedal steel guitar, and I learned how to play it. And, man, I tell you what, I've loved playing music.
So other than the first guitar that Grandpa got you, that Hawaiian guitar, you bought all your steel guitars from the Chicago store in Tucson.
Yeah. And there was a guy named Phil there. And Phil, I mean, he was really a good guy, and he had a brother named Joe, but those two guys, they ran the Chicago store. If you walked in the Chicago store for the first time, if it was Phil or if it was Joe that you met, that was the permanent person that you would be dealing with, and they never varied to the other person. I bought so many steel guitars from Phil, I just can't count them all, but my wife and I, we went to their big store, which they had moved into a JCPenney store on a corner of Congress and 6th, I believe. And we went upstairs, and I found my first lap Hawaiian guitar there with my name on it.
Wow. I never knew that.
Yeah. And I was amazed when I saw it. I mean, I painted my name on there, Sonny. And I was so proud to find that thing there. And the Chicago store had more musical instruments than any store. I think it was the biggest musical instruments in the United States.
I think it was, but, well, I appreciate it. I know we're running out of time, but thank you so much, Dad, for sharing these memories. Really means a lot.
Thank you for asking me.
Thank you, Dad.
I love you.
Love you, too.